Tonight I'm very happy to have one of the co-founders of Many Rivers Itself, Rob Schmidt, here to speak again. In my opinion, he doesn't speak often enough, so I'm really happy that he's taken on the task this evening. He is, as I mentioned, he's one of the co-founders of Many Rivers Books and Tea. He's one of the directors of the Taiyu Meditation Center, and he is one of the co-directors of the Conscious Family Festival Project. He also has a PhD in, I always get this wrong, archaeological anthropology, and he is one of the editors of Archaeologies of Sexuality. And tonight he will be discussing one of spirituality's perennially favorite subjects, the empty self. The archaeology of the empty self. Thank you, Rob.
Thank you, and great to have you all here. I appreciate your coming. The subject for this talk was not my idea, but was suggested by acclamation at one of our meditation group meetings a few weeks ago. And actually, it was archaeology of the self, and I was the one who had it empty. So we'll see if I can justify that. But I like, of course, the idea of bringing a different perspective on this question that Jim points out is an unusual question. Excuse me, a typical question, a perennial question, as Jim put it, in the annals of spiritual investigation. And archaeology, of course, not generally thought of as being relevant to spiritual investigation. But let me make a case for why there's a useful co-creation possible here with this topic. Some of you who may have read some of the stuff, some of the notices that I sent out about this topic, will have seen that I actually ended up writing two introductions to this talk. One was a little drier, talks about Buddhist and Gurdjieffian ideas about the self and the soul. Not that the two are necessarily linked, but they often are, of course, and that's one of the sticking points in many of the discussions about self. But I then, in reflecting on that slightly dry description, I then went back and came up with another take on it, which was, of course, my mother's question whenever she thought I was getting too uppity or too out of control, or as I put it in the description there, which I think is actually more accurate, when she thought I was being too self-absorbed, she would ask in her inimitable way, "Who do you think you are?" And she would say it much more emphatically than I just did. So she's a strong lady and a smart lady, and certainly saw through me in many ways very clearly. So I wanted to put that element into our questioning here, because sometimes when we look at the question of what is the self, is the self related to the so-called soul, if there's a soul? If it is, how does that relationship work? You'll note, those of you who read it, that of course there are different takes on this, and the Buddhist take of an Atman is one take that many of you will be familiar with. The idea that if we examine the self, we end up finding that there is no separately existing self. And of course, in the Catholic theology that I grew up with as a kid, the self sort of would be reduced to the soul, which was a permanent, understood to be, or it was asserted to me, and I accepted it as a kid, that the self was this permanent thing whose dimensions and character were hard to describe, but it would be unique to me. My soul would be different than Carl's soul. And his soul would be different than Patrick's soul, etc. So there are these ideas about it. And Gurdjieff comes along, of course, in the early 20th century and makes the assertion that actually it's not, the soul is a nice idea, but really, if you want to have something that survives your life, you actually have to create that through what he would call intentional suffering. And that would be a consequence of what we might call rigorous self-examination. Much could be said about that, because that's not what I want to focus on tonight. So, any questions about that? I mean, by the way, stop me anytime that you have a question or comment or some other.
I wonder how many people heard that, because that was, who do you think you are? I got that from both my mother and my father. And I'm just curious how many people here had that phrase. It must have been a just one of those.
I think
phrases.
It was a meme in of that generation. Yeah. I suspect.
I actually can't say because my mother said it.
Did you ever say that?
Just a little bit. Okay. Well. I guess we could ask Odin if he ever heard it from his parents. No? So it could be an age-related phenomenon here, which is interesting. I'm sure it's cultural, that's for sure. There was a certain place where that question was asked in a particular way with a particular agenda, the agenda being to, I think often, to deflate what was perceived to be inflated in self-perception. So anyway, that's kind of our background here. And I start with that question, who do I think I am? Because really, that's what my spiritual teacher, when I first started spiritual work 37 years ago, 38 years ago, that was the question, essentially, although not with the tone that my mother, and the spin that my mother put on it. That was the question that he suggested I ask myself, and that's why we're here. And there are many, you know, I'm not scholar enough to go through all the many ways that only Buddhists have examined this question. There are lots of ways that many different spiritual traditions, the Buddhists are particularly famous because of the whole anatman, no self, idea that the Buddha was so famous for offering. But I think you, a fair argument could be made that many or most spiritual traditions have this concern at the core. What I want to offer to start with here is an archaeological take, since that's in the title, and I don't want to fail to give you your donation money's worth. So I do have a good background in archaeological reasoning. That was something that my teachers at Berkeley were very good at providing. And there are a lot of ways in which we can apply the understanding of archaeology to this topic of the investigation of the self. For example, archaeology is not, for the most part, and I'll explain what I mean in a moment, for the most part it's not an experimental science. We can't set up an experiment, for the most part, to investigate the cultural lives of people in the past. because it only happened once. In each case, it was a unique occurrence. There is something called experimental archaeology, and that is the use of techniques to reproduce effects on a material culture record that we might look for in the past. Like, people would spend like 72 hours. You'd put some artifacts in a plot, you know, square plot, and then you have undergraduates walking over those plots for like 72 hours in a row, something like that. And then you see what happens to the pieces that have been buried, and you know, it might be ceramics, it might be bones, it might be some other form of material culture. And that's experimental archaeology. And we do that to see what happens when something that hopes to simulate conditions over a long period of time, what we can expect to find in the archaeological record. So we can make inferences about that. That's the experimental archaeology part, and I'm going to link that to the self-investigation part in a moment, I hope. But to back up again, archaeology is about something unique that we can't do experiments about. And so is, I'll argue, our self-investigation of the self. Self-investigation. What are we looking at? It's not something that we can put in a beaker and apply heat to. It's not something that we can even manufacture a very reasonable analog of, because the archaeological record is the product of human behavior, which, as we know from our own lives, is really complicated. If you wrote down everything you did, and were really quite rigorous about specifying all the physical activities of your body, we're not even talking about the mind here, all the physical activities of your body in a day, and I'm not talking about, you know, glossing summary, I walked to the store, I took, you know, 272 steps, then I, you know, went into the produce section and I picked up a cantaloupe, and I smelled the stem end, and et cetera, et cetera. If you did that, it would be a lot of work. And similarly, it's a lot of work to do self-investigation. Doesn't mean it can't be done, but we have to be smart about how we do it. In archaeology, we use samples. We take samples, and then we assume that those samples have a validity for the wider set of behaviors that we're interested in understanding. And I'm going to suggest that similarly, in self-investigation, there are ways that we can, as it were, take samples. We can intentionally decide to examine parts, discrete chunks of our behavior in ways that allow us to get the equivalent of a sample from which we can make inferences. In this case, the inferences would be about, well, what is this self thing, if it exists? If it exists, is it unchanging, or is it mutable? If it's mutable, how is it mutable? Under what conditions is it mutable? If it's not, if it's not mutable, then how is it that we have people appearing to change their minds all the time, often in ways that are notable and dramatic? So that's one arena of similarity. Did you have a question, Michael? Okay. So, So that's an arena of similarity between act of intentional self-investigation and archaeological investigation. We're looking at something that we can't see directly in a certain sense. We can't see the past directly. We can see the indirect effects of the past in material that we perhaps dig up, or sometimes nowadays there's all kinds of new techniques, and you might have various scans where you don't even have to do excavation and you can find evidence of buildings or whatever. All kinds of interesting stuff happening with Stonehenge actually right now about that. I shouldn't say Stonehenge itself, but the whole site around, this vast area around Stonehenge, all kinds of cool stuff there. But similarly, I'll suggest that self-investigation, whatever self is, self-investigation works the same way. We don't really know. We can't look directly at what the self is, because you tell me. You guys tell me what it is. I'd like to know. I mean, there's all kinds of assertions about the self, and yet I want something that I can rely on personally. So I need to know about this self here that I have the most access to. It's not that I don't have access to your self nature, whatever that might be, I will argue. Also, because if there is something that it's useful to call a self, then it's not like you're hiding it, or I'm hiding it from myself. I'm not deliberately hiding it. I'm going to suggest that like archaeological evidence, there is evidence of behavior that we leave behind us, as it were, that we can look at, that we can examine, and that is interesting, relevant, even fascinating, if we decide to do that. Was that a question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, if I said that the self is a tool for making more than one.
For making more than one what?
more than one of us.
Okay.
So, the self is a community, and then I love the question. It's such a rich question.
Well, I think it is a rich question, because I mean, this whole thing about anatman, that Buddhist doctrine of no separately existing self is simply a restatement of there's in our Tayu practice we have a saying. It's called "I am that I am, thou art that I am," and it's meant to evoke that we mutually create each other, and not just two of us, but all of us. But anyway, go ahead.
Mary Baba spoke of the sacred illusion,
mm-hmm.
and I see that as the illusion of separation. I like to say that without the miracle of separation, there couldn't be the greater miracle of sacred encounter.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more.
And so it's like a game that we're playing with ourselves, or that something is playing with something. I think ultimately, I think the goal is just to sink into the mystery and surrender to the mystery.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And I'll suggest that there are. I mean, this is getting ahead of myself here, but I'll suggest that there are. Really interesting ways to surrender to the mystery. It's not just a passive, It's not just the air going out of the self or the you, but it's something potentially very creative, very creative. So I mean I don't want to develop that further right now, but I see another question here or comment.
It's not really a question. So are you? I mean, I do have at least my perception based on all my reading of what the self is. Are you looking for those?
I'm not looking for any, I'm happy to hear what you have to say about it.
Okay. And it ties into the Atman, and it also ties in, I think, to maybe an Orthodox theology, mm-hmm. Christian theology.
Uh-huh. And I'm not surprised.
My view
like that.
Of the self is imagine that our essence is light,
mm-hmm.
and meaning my temperature is 98.6. So my body is animated because there's a presence of God in all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, we wouldn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what self is a separation. In other words, I'm talking to you because there's because in my consciousness is developed from light that's animating my body, that's literally scanning my brain. That's my picture of self.
Okay.
So within that scanning of my mind, that laser beam of light, then exists consciousness. And in that and the Atman, what you're talking about, is when the consciousness comes to a space or within contemplation. And this is more like Orthodox theology, which ties into the Atman that you were talking about, of internal oneness. So where you're saying there's only really no separate self, that's essentially true as well, because enlightenment is when one reaches inside and merges with the God within, as though two fires are merging in one, and that's the annihilation of the separate self.
Got it.
That's my version of.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it. But my goal, mm-hmm. because I'm this pretty earthy. There's a story about me. Mm-hmm. We haven't gotten the story yet. Quite yet. But there's a story. Is that I tend to have an earthy practical side,
mm-hmm.
and so my question is how. Do I bring light into every, to use the metaphor you're using, into every cell of my body? How does that manifest in the creative, in the co-creation, the creative co-creation that would follow from Michael's comments earlier? So, I'll throw another complication, if you will, in. One of the things that I've become more drawn to accept in recent years is the idea that if we co-create each other, if I am that I am and thou art that I am as well, then I have a level of responsibility. It's not enormous, perhaps, but I have a level of responsibility for what you do, for how you experience your life. So that puts an onus on me, if I accept this, to the extent that I accept this view. And I'm not saying anyone should without good evidence, and that's precisely the point of this talk in a way, but the point is to offer a way to do that, not just to describe. There are many beautiful descriptions, and you just offered one, a beautiful description of what the self might be, and I have no problem with that description, and yet here I am saying, I want to bring and dip this body into that light, if you will.
Cool.
And how do I do that? And that's through this method of, which I haven't even gotten to yet. Which I'm going to use as I go on. I'm going to use this metaphor of archaeological investigation in order to confirm for myself, not for anyone else, but for myself, and to the extent that it's useful for anyone else, fine, that's wonderful. I'm happy to share it. That's what I'm sitting up here doing, and I don't expect, nor would I wish anyone to accept what I have to say without testing it in their own experience. So that's the first thing. That's the first place I would want to go. Yeah.
So just to clarify, the book that you've written in is your description, or I'm paraphrasing, and tell me if I'm off or on, your description of a method of using some experimental archaeology or archaeological investigation to...
No book.
Oh, there isn't a
book. Well, I have a book, but that's just from my actual active archaeology days. I'm no longer actively in the field.
Okay.
So, but that book that...
So your talk tonight, then?
The talk is...
About how you can use those same methods?
Those same principles.
For self-improvement.
I wouldn't even call them methods exactly, but it's principles. So for example, when I was in grad school, one of the things that that everyone in the Berkeley program that I was in was exposed to was something called the method. Excuse me, I'm blanking on the exact title, which is funny. The method of multiple lines of evidence. The method of multiple lines of evidence. And the idea is, in a non-experimental science, but also in an experimental science, this would apply as well, but especially in a non-experimental science, like archaeology, it is really important to bring multiple lines of evidence to bear to support any interpretation or story that we create. To account for the evidence that we see. And what would that mean? In archaeology, it might mean that I want paleoethnobotanical, paleoethnobotanical evidence, which would be the evidence of the plant species that were alive and present in an area. If I'm looking at, say, human subsistence practices in an area, I would want to know what kind of plants were alive at that time. But in addition to that line of evidence, it would be great also to have, let's say, residues inside ceramic utensils,
which I could... Pollen spores.
Well, pollen spores, or more likely to be charred food. It could be lots of different things. And I might also, of course, want to see some of the animal bones to see not just what animals were being processed, but how they were being processed, where in a site where they're being processed, etc. All those things would bring multiple lines of evidence to bear for me to understand how people fed themselves, how they survived in whatever context they were living in. So that's the method of multiple lines of evidence.
Can you give us an example of how you would do that with self-inquiry?
Well, that's exactly where I was going. First, I'm going to get some more tea, though. But I can talk from over here.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, first I'm going to pour myself water first, because that makes noise. Maybe Stuart can delete this from the recording when he does that later. So in this application of the principle or the method of multiple lines of evidence in self-investigation, what might be some of the different... I mean, I have some ideas about it, but maybe you guys have some ideas about it.
I would like for you to give us an example similar to how you just did with archaeology, with self-inquiry.
Okay, well, let me then... because self-inquiry is a little different than archaeology, I'm going to say, in that in archaeology you have to ask a specific question if you're going to hope to get a coherent answer. That's not necessarily untrue in self-examination, but I will suggest that at the beginning of a rigorous self-investigation process, we really don't know what question other than, who the heck am I? What am I doing? Why am I doing it? You know, that's about as narrow as is going to be useful at the beginning. I'm not saying that later you couldn't, and I could give examples later of more narrowly conceived questions. But first we have to start off where we're at, which is like me with my mother, who do you think you are? That kind of thing.
That's like an artifact.
Yeah, that's absolutely an artifact.
So let's say you found that artifact, and you're going to apply
in myself. Well, let me first tease out this how the analog to the method of multiple lines of evidence first. So I have a vocabulary to talk from, and then I'm happy to address that question. So some of the, or one of the lines of evidence might be, how do other people react to what I do and say? Quite simple, really. And yet, one of the important things about rigorous self-investigation is that often when we say, oh, I'll listen to what other people have to say, and I'll pay attention to what they say. Actually, turns out that most of us have, and certainly, I'm a sinner, if that's the word to use here, as anyone else in this area. It's hard to listen to other people. It's hard to be present to feedback from other people in many cases. I mean, if they say something nice, that's not so hard. But what if they say something that we don't particularly find pleasant to hear? Or, more specifically, what if they say something that does not... It may not be negative, but it doesn't accord with whatever story we have running in the background in our head at the particular moment that we happen to hear it. We're likely to go, huh? At best. Or, no way! Whether voiced or not. So it's not a trivial... The cultivation of that particular line of evidence is not a trivial problem. Michael?
So interesting. I just found myself looking at my process here, because I'm always writing new flyers.
Yes.
And then there's the feeling that I have when I offer this flyer. And so sometimes it's very easy to offer a flyer, and sometimes I notice there's a reticence.
Absolutely.
And a hesitation where I know that I'm going to be pushing this person's buttons.
Or you think you are, at least.
I think I am.
Right.
And sometimes I'll get a response, and I'll just go right back and I'll write a new one. Mm-hmm. It's searching for myself. It's really a searching for myself. And who do I want to be, as opposed to who I might be?
Who do I want to be perceived as by others?
Well,
it can be part of it.
because that's a part of it. But who do I want to?
Who is it who's wanting to be?
Exactly.
Who's the I?
Who wants to be in the first place? I found myself thinking just before that about the self of individual words in a sentence,
mm-hmm.
and how a word needs to move into a kind of integrity before it can hold its place in a sentence and actually serve the transmission of meaning,
mm-hmm.
the movement of words, and the integrity of letters in a word, and the selfhood. It's such a rich arena for just wondering about and observing. And I want to do everything I can to avoid answers.
And that's and thank you for saying that last bit in particular. I want to do everything to avoid answers, or at least settling on answers is how I would put it. It's not like that I want to avoid answers. It's that I don't want to settle on an answer, because that means I've stopped listening. If I've settled on an answer, it means I've stopped listening. So I think that's that's an important part of how we can use the response of the universe to our manifestation as one of these multiple lines of evidence,
mm-hmm.
to investigate what my self is. And you've already implied here, I think, that we can understand that class of phenomena, the responses of the universe to me, as potentially having many natures, and not just whether so and so likes my new shirt or something like that, you know, and or whether they like my book, or whether they like what I just said, or you know, or whether they want to come to this this cool Shakuhachi benefit, you know. I mean, those sorts of things are wonderful fields for looking at, noting, being present to the effects of whatever a self would be creating in my experience, in the experience of this flesh and blood being here. So that's one of the things. Another potential line of evidence, or set of lines of evidence, would be when there are no people around. So what is it, let's say I'm on a hike alone in the woods and there's no other human being around. What is the response of my body to being in that place? What is the response of my body, and take it back the other direction, when you are around other people, what's the response of my body to other people? Some people, my body has a definite response to, and it might be attraction or repulsion. It might be difficult to pin down combination of those two. You know, there's lots of ways. It's often said that kids will take an instant liking or disliking to people that they haven't met before. And my teacher used to say that was a phenomenon that was a discernment possible for every one of us, and yet when we get to be adults, we get all these narratives going on. Maybe I can bring in the narrative thing here for a moment before proceeding on with the lines of evidence, because the narrative thing I did want to bring it up. It's an important part of this phenomenon of self, I think. Certainly, the way we construct our experience is based on at least one, and I will argue many, stories that we tell about ourselves internally, whether we ever acknowledge them outside ourselves or not. Yeah, I believe.
But, I mean, going back to my own life, you know, I'm at a stage where I have stopped believing in people's words or books' words, and I've read all this, and so I want to see what happens in my own life, actually, factually, you know. So when I see myself that I had certain experiences, I was born in India, I was born in a certain family, so there were some conditionings right from the childhood. And when I got out of that environment and went to, you know, environment to a bigger environment, and so all these experiences have created a sort of a center in me from where I act.
I understand what you're saying.
So, I mean, it's a conditioned response, you know. And sometimes I can see that conditioned response. Sometimes I can't see it.
Yes.
And it happens automatically, you know. It happens so quickly that, you know.
Yes.
So, I mean, so just like you were saying that, and each person, I think, has his own experiences, and he's he has got his own environment and was brought up, and his own experiences. So obviously his liking or disliking, he acts from his center, perhaps. I mean, I don't know, but I can talk, for example, today I was showing my wife, because I was very much interested in Indian classic music, and one of the, you know, vocal was very interesting to me, and I called my wife on the YouTube to show her. And she says, yeah, but can we switch to something, you know?
So I guess she was not so excited.
I just, you know.
That's never happened to me. I'm joking.
So I think each has its own, I mean, conditioning. And so it depends on, you know, what conditioning you have been through, and that impacts your judgment or your own center.
I
don't know whether this is true or not, but this is true in my case.
I believe that most of us have, you know, there's lots of ways that different traditions have to describe the weight of what you're describing, the weight that we experience of what you're describing. And I'll also, there's two things here. One is that there's actually, it's not just one story, even though we tell ourselves that we have a coherent story throughout our life. I'll suggest for your consideration, I don't have time to establish this right now a little better, but I'll suggest that in fact we have many stories. In fact, I'll suggest that almost every time you blink your eye, you're switching to another story. You're switching to a very slightly, distinctly different story, literally like that. So so that's one thing. And yet the point that is relevant to what you've just said is that mostly we don't experience ourselves as making choices in that process. So there's a weight which we feel. We experience something, and by association, we experience the thing associated with that, with whatever that last thing was, and then the next thing, and then the next thing. And there's no, it's an endless loop for the most part, unless we do something to stop it. And mostly we don't. And there's another point of view here, about the multiplicity of stories, which is that if we cultivate the capacity to hold the story, not to throw it out, not to say no to it, but not to believe it as the final answer, as Michael was saying earlier, then there's actually room for new interpretations, new stories to arise. You know, I could go into how that has arisen for me personally, but it didn't arise just by happenstance. It arose because I created the intention to establish this self-investigation process. I made a commitment to that process in myself to be open to these new possible interpretations. And that, at this point, I want to jump back again to the methods again, and just add another method, possible method to this multiple, this method of multiple lines of evidence. And another line of evidence might be the experience that we have when we examine the contents of the mind and heart in a way that we do not generally do. Jim, in his Quaker tradition, might call that interior silence. Other traditions have different ways to configure that, advice and technologies to accomplish something similar. What I'm suggesting is that when we have that technology implemented, and by that I mean we have created the habit more and more rigorously, more and more continuously, more and more thoroughly, to create the capacity to cultivate that interior silence, then that interior silence creates a field in which another line of evidence is possible. It's a line of evidence about that bears on the capacities and the definition of the self that cannot offer us anything, that offers us things that we cannot get from the discursive methods that I was talking about earlier. That is, when we sort of meditate, mull over our experience in our mind discursively, and make distinctions in our mind. Now, I'm not saying that any of those things is the single way. In fact, I'm saying precisely the opposite. I'm saying all of those methods, all of those lines of evidence are relevant to the process of getting interesting data about what this self might be. And what this self might be begins to have different products. It begins to have a different feel. It begins to have a different space, different context as well, as we employ all these methods. So in our Taiyu practice, we do something to correspond to the first line of evidence that I talked about. We do something called co-meditation, which is where we sit and look into the eyes of another person, and they're looking into mine, and we simply put our full attention on the other person. And then there's a whole raft of elaborations of that where we bring speech into it later. But at first, it's just this silent presence with another being. And then there's, the different meditative forms, all of which, you know, are wonderful things. People are drawn. Some people like Zen meditation. Other people like Vipassana. Some people like centering prayer. Some people, you know, there's a whole range of things. I do something called self-observation meditation, which comes out of the Gurdjieffian tradition. And, you know, and that one has the benefit of being something that I can do right now in the midst of daily life. Mm-hmm. When I'm talking to someone, I don't have to go off, I don't have to create special conditions to do it. But that's just me. Some people would not prosper with that. That would not be conducive for them. But I am suggesting that for each of us, just as there are so many, there's this wide array of archaeological pasts to look at, and they are so amazingly different. One of the wonderful things about my time in the field of archaeology was the incredible variety of the way that human beings have created their lives. You begin to get a little taste of that from that, and also the variety of ways that people investigate those lives in the past. Those are different depending on the lines of evidence that are available for different cultural contexts. So there's the arena of historical archaeology where you get documentary sources. But of course you have to remember that almost until the very, very, very recent times, the only documentary sources were from people who are elites, basically, or employed by elites. And so it doesn't tell us much about the vast majority of people, except by absence. It doesn't tell us much about the lives of the vast majority of people. So all these different lines of evidence in archaeology are relevant in certain times and certain places, and similarly, I'm suggesting, in a rigorous self-investigation process, we can also employ different lines of evidence, and we are doing best when we employ the most lines of evidence. Not necessarily at any single time, although there are those epiphany moments when it all, you know, can feel like it's coming together in marvelous ways that I could not control, that I could not generate. Except to create myself as a field in which those things can come together. But there are these means, these methods that allow us to get a feel for who this self is differently than I would have if I did not employ the various methodologies, the different lines of evidence, intentionally creating my behavior such that my awareness is drawn to those things. That's important, of course. I said intention before, how intention is useful. Is that it directs our attention. Intention directs attention. And that's how we can create those habits of the attention direction such that we get this incredibly rich picture. Is an inadequate word, but it does include the fact that, like art, like most art, it may relate to words, but it is not composed solely of words, that's for sure. So whatever the self is, I'm suggesting, we need more than words. Words are great, don't get me wrong. Words are very important. Words, the attention we put on words and the attention we put on our reception the reception in here of the words that we hear from others and read and are exposed to in various ways, those things are very informative. And yet, it's not only words. If we only have words, then my contention would be, then we only are creating a the metaphor that my teacher used to use, and that's why I stuck it in the flyer there, is a hall of mirrors. And in the hall of mirrors, we don't know, we don't really have much hope of isolating one image from another image. They're all reflecting each other. And what's real? Which is true or more true than another? There's no way to know. We need something more than just that, and so we need these multiple lines of evidence, including the silence, including the capacities of the human consciousness to tune into things that are beyond words, as well as to embrace the creativity that words give us. So, questions, comments? Yes, sir.
I heard someone said once that the individual was the latest development in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And I just found my thoughts going there.
My thoughts have gone there in the past as well.
And it's like asking the question, what is the individual? Is that question similar to what is the self?
I think so. I think it's not irrelevant.
Has the individual arrived yet? Or is it still in the process
well,
of arriving?
Gurdjieff and others, other folks that I have some respect for would, suggest that that really three-brained beings, that's what Gurdjieff called it, three-brained beings, as opposed to most mammals, which would be two-brained beings. But our additional cortical matter, he would identify as the third brain, which gives us possibilities that other mammals don't have. And his view was that it's a work in progress. And gosh, if you look at the human social universe and even the physical world, the effects on the physical world of the human social universe right now, it would be hard to argue with that, really, in a lot of ways. We are like infant leviathans who don't know our own strength, don't understand our capacities, and we blunder about and harm one another, suffer, and haven't got it down yet. We're working on it. So you had a question.
Yeah, I mean, my perception, I was kind of waiting to see, well, you kind of almost hinted on it right there at the end. To me, part of what makes people different cells,
mm-hmm.
is, for example, good and evil,
mm-hmm.
and light being associated with good or righteousness, evil being associated with darkness, virtue, vice, virtue being associated with the light, vice, the opposite, so every virtue has a vice.
Mm-hmm.
And so God, in essence, is love, so of course God is all virtue. So if that's the case, we're shades, almost like you can look at white and you can look at black and then you can look at gray. Mm-hmm. There's lighter shades of gray and there's darker shades of gray. And human intellect is pretty much, my perception is pretty much that. Some of us are lighter shades of gray and some of us are darker shades of gray. Mm-hmm. Some of us put more effort into virtue, but some of us put more effort into vice.
Got it.
And I think that has a huge, and I do think one last thing, Kant said that every human being has a moral stamp, a conscience.
Mm-hmm.
So part of our perception is that's just God-given from up front. We all have it.
Mm-hmm.
So our reaction to what we do and the events that go through our life create this perception of ourself that is our conscious self based on the story, the narrative that we do, basically related to virtue and vice.
Got it. So my you know, one response I would have to that is that to me the crucial thing, and this sort of extends the previous thread of discussion, is that the integration of our intellectual capacity into the whole of the organism, such that when we hurt something or someone, we actually feel it in our toes.
Conscience.
Yes, and Gurdjieff would say that it is basically dormant in most human beings for reasons that we don't have time to go into tonight. And if that's true, then the task is to awaken ourselves to that so-called still small voice of conscience. I like that phrase, still small voice, because it brings in that other dimension that I was talking about, that other line of evidence, that non-discursive line of evidence that we were talking about earlier. And it implies that we can override it all too readily. And our even trained is not the right word, but the examples we see enacted around us are of people overriding it all too often. And that gets incorporated into who we are. So conscience has no audible voice, perhaps. This is just one way to conceive it. I'm not saying that this is the way it is, like I would know. Conscience, if we can make it something that speaks to us through the pores of our skin, if we can make it something that speaks to us in our gonads, in our belly, then that's an accomplishment. That's a worthy challenge for a three-brained being. And it relates to the point that Baldi brought up earlier about this legacy of you could call it, well, it's just legacy of upbringing, whether it has a relationship beyond this lifetime. Whatever the factors in this lifetime are more than enough to explain these drags on our capacity to direct our attention. So we want to be supple with our attention. We want to be supple in that I want my toes to be able to feel conscience. I want my skin to be able to sense that which the universe is telling me is through a gentle zephyr brushing against my skin. I want to be able to tune into lines of evidence that are both blunt and oh so delicate. And that's how I'm going to create a capacity for supple attention, direction in my life. So that even the smallest thing, by most standards, I see and note. And I have the capacity to respond or not consciously depending on the context of circumstance. So
but the thing is, the word is so brutal, you know. at times.
It is often brutal.
You're talking about an instrument in which you put a micro voltage and it deflects.
Yes.
Siebert put it in 440 volts.
It's true. It's true. So that's why. That's that's one of the reasons for this Conscious Family Festival thing, project of mine. That's, you know, it didn't arise out of a conscious decision. It did not arise out of a conscious decision. I was standing in front of 140 people, and suddenly I found myself saying the words, "I am committed to creating loving, nurturing contexts for kids." And then I had to find a way to make that real. And the words, I suggest to you, did not precede. It was some impulse that the words were an expression of. I mean, just to return briefly, and then I need to stop shortly. We talked about narrative and storytelling, and how the self is often understood to be a story. And that's, you know, a common way to view the story and the self and the relationship between the two. And we generally understand that words give shape to our idea of the self. And even beeping phones. So there are these words that shape things. But my teacher asserted that, in fact, there's one of the products of spiritual practice, of the application of the method of multiple lines of evidence in the context of spiritual endeavor, is to have the effect of having words being not the preceding source, but the effect that arises from the source, which does not start from words.
Are you talking about the heart?
That is certainly one way to, but I think, but he would have asserted not just the heart, but the amalgamation of the heart, the mind, and the body. That was his view, and you know, it's one that I'm I continue to investigate myself. But that's a somewhat different view than most people have, and certainly a different experience than most of us have. When my teacher told me that I could drive a car without thinking, I was like, I'll kill myself. You're crazy. You're nuts. You know, because that was the level of my commitment to the story of I am my thoughts. I am the voices in my head. Got to remember, this was the 70s. This is a long time ago. This is ancient history, dude. and that was the understanding in the culture generally. It really was. So there have subsequently come voices asserting other things, but I don't think most Americans, for example, would really challenge that view. Or most people generally.
Wasn't that just attention, awareness? You can have total attention without any thoughts.
Totally. And how do we create the capacity to know what you're calling the heart so well that it can self-express through action and word, without going through a process of vetting what I do and say? Most of us have the experience of, I run through what I think, what I'm going to say to someone to make sure it's okay first. It's often happens so quick that unless we have a meditative history, we don't see that process happening. But But that is, I will assert, and you can test it in your own experience, and check it out for yourself, but I will assert that that's often how people experience the operation of the mind, whether they realize it or not. And when they examine it, I suggest that's how it often can seem to be. So so it's not simple, because we're talking about creating a capacity, a set of habits of the direction of attention, such that we can model something that we don't see modeled in the world around us very often, because most people are not coming from that place. And that's why people go to spiritual teachers, really, because they can see it modeled. They can see it modeled, at least if the teacher has some integrity and capacity in that regard.
You're talking about calling the same attention to the pre-verbal that we give to the verbal.
So
aren't you just talking about feelings? Being attentive to your feelings and the way that you react to those.
Actually, I'm not just talking about that. I'm suggesting that there's a capacity. I'm not excluding what we would consider feelings at all. That's part of what makes up this capacity, I'm suggesting. And yet it is not just feelings, because mostly what people think of feelings are reactive to our experience. And there are Gurdjieff called them higher emotions, which are ones whereby we generate, sort of like the metaphor you are using, like we're generating compassion, or we're generating not a feeling, but a clarity of mind. So those are different, and those would be related to the development of, and that then the expression of those things are related to that. Well, I think we've just about done any final comments, question, observation, otherwise. I'm going to thank you this has been fun for me, and thank you so much for coming out tonight. Our final event for 2015, and then we have the incredible treat. I'm so looking forward to Jim's talk on Madame Guyon, because number one, how often do we get to hear about a woman mystic that most people know nothing about? That's cool, right there. That's cool. So that will be a good start. So we have good bookends, and thank you so much. That's in January 7th. Because we're taking a break now in terms of events at the store because we want to sell. We need to sell. So buy. No more Thursdays until. Yeah, actually, you know what happened? It wasn't only because we decided this way. Actually, the universe created it this way. I mean, we were going to do two of them, 3rd and the 10th, today and the next one. And everybody who said they were interested, crapped out as it fell out. So it was like, oh, well, I guess I'll do a talk, and then that'll be it. So, and that's fine. I am perfectly happy to accept that verdict from the universe.
What did you learn about yourself tonight?
I learned that I could talk about archaeology and spiritual practice with much intermeshing them much better than I imagined I could. So that's fun. That's cool. Really, I mean, I spent a lot of time developing my capacity to make contributions to the field of archaeology. And that book is the main one, my dissertation too, but that book over there is the main one. And now I'm, I was glad, this is just a parenthetical side note, but that book started a little sort of sexuality studies sub-field in anthropological archaeology, which I went to the Society of American Archaeology meetings in April in San Francisco, and it still continues. There are still sessions and stuff like that. So it's like, oh yeah, I did something that had an effect in this area, in the arena. That's really wonderful, because I put it aside because I'm doing other things now. But that's very gratifying. So I'm happy to have that message from the universe. And I'm also happy to be here using that, all that experience, which most people wouldn't link together, in a way that I hope was meaningful tonight. Thank you.
Thanks.